Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 is where you can listen to fresh new releases from any genre, any day of the week. Visit cjsf.ca for the latest open mic schedule.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book What's Yours Is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. Last show, we were looking at the section What's Yours Is Mine, subchapter Ratings as Surveillance. Despite their failings, reputation systems do serve a useful purpose for sharing economy transactions. The orthodoxy around reputation systems is that critical reviews provide information to other peers. But as we have seen, that there is little information about quality to be gained from sharing economy reputation scores. Instead, critical reviews act as a complement to the central authority of the sharing economy company. The reputation system is useful to keep service providers in line. Most people are going to give a good review unless their experience was very, very bad. But there is a small group of customers who are happy to provide critical reviews, and those reviews can have a big impact. A slip from 4.6 to 4.5 in an Uber driver's rating is not like the slip in the rating of a movie on Netflix. It does not meaningfully affect the perception of the driver by other customers. Instead, a bad rating is a complaint to Uber itself, which has its own unaccountable disciplinary system that can remove drivers from the platform for any reason. The threat of a bad review becomes a trap waiting to open in front of the driver. Uber drivers' discussion boards show a consistent fear over occasional bad ratings. How did they come about? Can they be appealed? Answer, no. How can they be avoided? Drivers must continuously worry about that 1 in 10 customer who will complain that you didn't offer them bottled water, or that you were overly friendly, or that you were not friendly enough. I have a comment here to make about my own experiences as a presenter of seminars, and that is, after 40 years of doing seminars, no matter how bad your seminar is, there'll always be at least one person who loved it. And no matter how good your seminar is, there's always at least one person who will hate it. Enough of my own commentary. Continuing with the book. That's not how sharing economy companies present the situation. The reputation systems ask people to speak quote-unquote honestly when rating service providers and to make criticisms of services that do not match up to expectations. Yelp gives an example of how this search for honesty plays out. Yelp filters the reviews that come into its site, including only trusted reviews in its overall rating. It gives priority in the selection of reviews to people who have a strong relationship with Yelp, known as its elite squad, but discounts the views of those who have strong relationships with the service providers, which they see as a source of bias. Yelp encourages a norm of market transactions, while many restaurateurs promote a norm of personal service. Is a bad review a quote-unquote honest rating, or is it a quote-unquote drive-by trashing? Is the reviewer providing a public good by notifying the broader public of their opinion through the platform, or acting in bad faith by not engaging with the service provider? It is no surprise that many restaurants don't like Yelp's ratings. Reviews by their most trusted customers are discarded, while anonymous reviews by one-time visitors are given a pride of place. A restaurateur's objection to a bad review on Yelp by a customer who never complained in person is not just sour grapes at an honest review. It is a clash of norms. If there are problems, restaurateurs hope customers will give them a chance to set things right, rather than going straight to the public shaming of a low review. If a rating is a mark of controversy, then asking customers to provide critical feedback is to encourage violation of the norms of courtesy. The more personal the customer service provider relationship, the more the friction between the reputation system and the norms of exchange. As Airbnb continues to tune its reputation system, it seems likely to follow the path that Yelp has forged. Airbnb researchers seeking to collect feedback from their customers suggest that guests may be choosing to omit negative feedback from public reviews, even when there is no possibility of retaliation, because they do not want to hurt the hosts they have socially interacted with. And they conclude, based on our results, marketplaces should design reputation systems to induce a higher share of participants to leave reviews and to solicit feedback in such a way that maximizes their perceived social distance between the reviewer and the reviewed. Airbnb marketing emphasizes the personal nature of its service, but the reputation system needs a quote-unquote social distance between host and guest if it is to collect the right input. In the cases of both Yelp and Airbnb, the reputation system erodes the very relationship that it seeks to evaluate. From the service provider's point of view, the reputation system becomes a form of surveillance, a, quote, denunciation system in which they may be publicly shamed at any moment and, in the case of a sharing economy platforms, punished. Sharing economy reputation systems have become fronts for hierarchical and centralized disciplinary systems, which they have nothing to do with notions of peer-to-peer reputation, algorithmic regulation, or regulation with a quote-unquote lighter touch through ratings. We trust strangers on sharing economy platforms for the same reason we trust hotel employees and restaurant waiters, because they are in precarious jobs where customer complaints can lead to disciplinary action. The reputation system is a way to enforce emotional labor. Service providers are compelled to manage their feelings and present the face of the platform demands to become that friend with a car or that neighbor helping neighbor. It's the fast food workers have a nice day taken to the next step. sharing economy reputation systems do not solve the problem of trust. At best, they provide a disciplinary mechanism that keeps service providers smiling and efficient by virtue of erratic and inconsistent ratings. For service providers, reputation systems are a form of surveillance mainly enacted by the most entitled and demanding customers on the platform for the community, for the notions of sharing with the sharing economy is supposed to be bringing back. Reputation systems are turning us into a society of snitches, giving us the ability to casually turn on our fellow citizens in a rather strict and unaccountable form of discipline. Chapter 7, A Short History of Openness. The sharing economy is only the latest wave of digital technology to take inspiration from the ideas of openness. The facts surrounding the movement will change rapidly, even by the time between the writing and publishing of this book. But there are forces that shape the development of this movement, as they have shaped previous waves of digital revolution. And we can look at these and other digital movements to understand where the sharing economy is likely to take us. This chapter and the next take a look at the broader digital environment from which the sharing economy has emerged and the ideas from which it takes its inspiration. Open source, open content, open data. Each of these promise to empower individuals while challenging the power of big corporations and governments. Just as the sharing economy claims to be on the side of the regular people against things like hotel chains and big taxi, so openness promised to be on the side of hobbyist coders against Microsoft, of living room musicians against the big record labels, of bloggers against big media companies. But one by one, these promises have been broken. Instead of producing a more level playing field, openness has replaced one set of power institutions with another, often even a more powerful set. This chapter describes how ideals of digital openness have been repeatedly appropriated for private gain. Brian Chesky writes that at Airbnb, we are creating a door to an open world where everyone's at home and can belong anywhere. Openness is almost a synonym for sharing, for the kind of exchange that goes beyond straightforward market transactions. It is central both to the broader appeal of the sharing economy and to the story that A&B... tells itself. Chesky's words echo those of Mark Zuckerberg, who started a letter to a potential Facebook investors this way. Quote, Facebook was not originally created to be a company. It was built to accomplish a social mission, to make the world more open and connected. As people share more, they have access to more opinions from the people they trust about the products and services they use. This makes it easier to discover the best products and to improve the quality and efficiency of their lives. Unquote. Zuckerberg may have forgotten that his original Facebook was actually a hot or not website, allowing Harvard students to compare pictures of students and vote on which was hotter. But he remembers that openness and sharing appeal to the best of us. The lowest point of the original background for Facebook, hot or not, was actually comparing several of the undergrad females at Harvard to farm animals. Openness was central to the beginnings of the internet. With the foundations created in university and government labs, DARPA, the source code for programs was shared among researchers who made up the early internet community. The early users, email and Usenet, were built on a distributed network of architecture with no central server. the earlier internet was a non-commercial, decentralized environment. The basic protocols and standards on which the internet was built were and are open. Not only were they open in their specification, anyone could implement them, but they were open in their philosophy. They were designed, for example, such that any computer could add itself to the network without having to ask permission of some administrator. The early software that ran the internet was also open, shared in a non-commercial fashion, largely among researchers and others in the university and government world. The World Wide Web was invented at CERN, and the first generation of web software was developed at government labs. The source code for these applications was not owned by individual companies. It was made available to anyone who wanted it as, quote-unquote, open source. Commercial use was forbidden on early government-funded processors, precursors to the Internet. But the 1992 Scientific and Advanced Technology Act allowed the U.S. National Science Foundation to interconnect with commercial networks, and the mixture of commerce and non-commercial activities started. There was voracious arguments over the ethics of pursuing profit over the Internet, but digital commerce nevertheless exploded. Digital openness, which was initially a norm of non-commercial world of resources, of researchers and enthusiasts cut off from the world of private property, was exposed to the profit motive, inevitably things would change. The internet is often seen as a natural place for openness because files and documents can be copied. I can give you a copy of a song and still keep a copy for myself. I can upload a video of YouTube and everyone can watch it. If software or songs are made open, they are no longer commodities that can be privately owned. They are made free for others and used as they wish. And so they are taken out of the normal commercial realm of buying and of selling. It seems like openness is an alternative to the commercial marketplace. But openness on the internet coexists with the market. YouTube has a way of sharing content, but it is also a for-profit part of a for-profit company. In these mixed environments, openness has two effects. The first effect, it disrupts existing markets. By cutting the price of a product or service to zero for everyone and for any purpose, it undermines the business of those who previously controlled access to that product or service. Making songs available for free on Napster was a threat to the business of the music labels and the main street music stores. It creates new markets in complementary offerings. Complements are products or services that go together, so that cutting the price of one increases demand for the other. File sharing increases the demand for internet service providers, file sharing sites, and digital music players. These new markets are doppelgangers, shadows that follow openness wherever it goes. New markets that spring up inevitably from the ruins of the old.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenari, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book What's Yours Is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. The disruption of existing markets appeals to those who want an alternative to the free market and who sees openness as a way to challenge existing hierarchies and power imbalances in society. It's a vision adopted by Airbnb when it speaks of its communities of regular people sharing the homes in which they live as an alternative to the mass-produced world of corporate hotel chains. But openness also attracts those who want to build bigger corporations. Commercial interests have repeatedly used non-commercial appeal of openness as a front for their own very real commercial agendas. The problem is, openness does not simply create new markets and new businesses to replace old ones. They disrupt. It tends to create less competitive markets and more powerful businesses. The markets disrupted by openness are often traditional in structure, characterized by decreasing returns. The market power that is distributed and limited in scope. The payoff to building a bigger music store is inevitably falls off and becomes uneconomic at some point, opening a space for specialist stores and competitors. Add too many new artists to music label, and it becomes impossible to promote them all. So music labels have to specialize and to compete. In contrast, constant fixed cost and zero marginal cost are the baseline case for information goods. So digital environments are characterized by increasing returns. The bigger you are, the bigger you get. The markets are likely to be oligopolistic, consisting of a few big firms, each with significant market power. For several years, Apple's iPod and Google's YouTube had no serious competitors. Many of the sources of increasing returns for digital marketplaces are lumped under the term network effects. Each new user of a service makes that service more valuable. Social media companies obviously benefit from network effects. You join the social media platform where the people that you want to meet hang out. But there are other, less obvious forms of increasing returns. Google learns from every search carried out in its platforms and so has a continuing advantage over its rivals, such as they are. Advertisers want to be on the search engine that the most people frequent. So the leading search engine will attract the most advertising money to feed its further growth. Other network effects are familiar from the brick and mortar world. A successful corporate brand can communicate familiarity and dependability and so grow faster. Or, as in the case with Amazon, a growing business provides money that can be reinvested in building more efficient infrastructure, driving the next cycle of competitive advantage. Not that network effects continue without limit. New technologies do come along to challenge existing ones, such as music streaming companies challenging Apple's iTunes Store. Also, cultural instincts don't just bind us all together on Facebook. They drive us apart as well. What teen wants to be on the same social networking site as their parents? So Snapchat and Instagram became the social networks for the next generation. And new entrants, such as Yahoo, Whisper, WhatsApp, Kick, and so on, try to create identities that will appeal to the new demographic. Faced with the generational changes in tastes, the best thing that this generation's company can do sometimes is to buy its challengers, as Facebook has done, by buying Instagram and WhatsApp. Network effects are not unique to the internet, but the internet provides an environment in which they can become particularly powerful. For one thing, they are not obviously limited by national borders in the way that, for example, phone networks are. Successful companies can become international without leaving home, without even trying. Google can serve up search results to Australians as easily as to Californians. The technical challenge of streaming a movie to Paris is not much different to streaming it to New York. Again, there are limits imposed by the physical aspects of a business. For example, Amazon needs to set up distribution centers, or the cultural aspects, language, for example, or the legal licensing restrictions, for example. But the potential for global reach is always there. The examples in this chapter show how digital openness has served to create these doppelganger markets for more than it has leveled the playing field between individuals and powerful institutions. Open source software. In 1991, a Finnish student, Linus Torvalds, started work just for fun on the open source operating system that was to become Linux, and it quickly became a phenomena. Linux was trumpeted as a triumph of the loosely coordinated amateur, that is, non-commercial efforts of hackers, that is, people programming for fun rather than as a job. In 1998, Eric S. Raymond stated in his famous essay, The Cathedral and the Bazaar, in this way, Linux is subversive. Who would have thought even 5 years ago that the world-class operating system would coalesce as if by magic out of the part-time hacking by several thousand developers scattered all over planet Earth, connected only by the tenuous strands of the internet? So in the future, we're going to be looking at the critical aspects of open source software and how it impacts society and what the future can hold for this. So thank you for listening in, and we'll talk to you next week.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio Salmon Fraser 90.1 FM.
This is Bird Note. In shallow waters off the coast of Massachusetts, ocean predators come from far and wide to hunt. Humpback whales break the surface as they close their jaws around a school of fish. And thousands thousands of seabirds dive in the water or skim the surface for easy prey. Great